Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support this program, and I'm very grateful to Deborah Hoover, Larry Duers in Costa Rica, Michelle Pasco, and Patricia Player. They're all voluntary subscribers. You can do it, too. Log on to peterbcollins.com. Our subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. In a moment, Mike Farrell joins us, the actor and activist who has spent 30 years fighting to abolish the death penalty in the United States. Illinois is the newest state to ban the death penalty. We'll give you the details here in just a moment. And later in this podcast, a first-person view of life in Saudi Arabia. John Paul Jones is an American who spent 20 years in the royal kingdom, and he's got a pretty favorable view of life there. You might find it surprising and counter to the stereotypes you often hear. And toward the end of the podcast, some interesting notes about U.S. military aid for Bahrain. That's our tanks, our bullets, aimed at the protesters there. Rock the nation. Illinois rocks the nation. They have abolished the death penalty and closed down their death row. Actor and activist Mike Farrell joins us in a moment, but first, listen up.
We live in the meantime, in an aggressive time, a painful time, a time where cynicism rots the vine, and a time where violence blocks the sunshine. Lifetimes go by in a flash, in a search for love, in a search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon, everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune, or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you fear me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slay and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay. No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine, pass the buck, or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. I think it's time to make a move on the contradiction. Bomb, bomb. Rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb.
That's Michael Franti, a San Francisco-based singer-songwriter, the frontman for Spearhead. And if you've never heard this before, I want to recommend this CD to you. It's called Stay Human, and that's one of the songs on it called Rock the Nation. But woven in between the tunes is a talk track where Michael Franti poses as a radio talk show host. Can you imagine that? And he's doing a show on the night of a scheduled execution of Sister Fatima. And this is partly fictional, partly real, but it's a very touching and high-impact presentation throughout the CD, and a stunning indictment of capital punishment in our country. Again, Michael Franti and Spearhead, it's called Stay Human. Mike Farrell returns to our program today, the actor and activist. And he, of course, is involved with Death Penalty Focus, an organization that he helped start. And he joins us from Los Angeles today. Mike, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure, Peter, as always.
And Mike is also the author of Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist that was published a couple of years ago. Mike, this is a pretty interesting development that the state of Illinois with a former governor who cleared or pardoned a number of people on death row because he was opposed to the death penalty. That's Governor George Ryan, who is now an inmate in the prison system in the state of Illinois. But he was followed by Rod Blagojevich, who's well known for his hair and his language, and that he beat the rap, at least so far. And the successor to Blagojevich, Democrat Pat Quinn, signed legislation just the other day on the 9th of March, which abolishes the death penalty and empties death row in the state of Illinois, the land of Lincoln. This is a pretty remarkable development, isn't it?
It is indeed, Peter. Let me, if I may, back up just a moment. George Ryan, who instituted initially the moratorium that led to this, ultimately to this action on Governor Quinn's part, was not opposed to the death penalty. He was a death penalty supporter, and over time, when he was confronted with the fact that 13 men had been sentenced to death in his state and had been exonerated, called for the moratorium, called for an investigation of the state's system, and ultimately was convinced that the system wouldn't work. So he became a convert, but he had initially started out as a supporter of the death penalty, a hot-ribbed Republican conservative, as he called himself.
Yeah, I appreciate the clarification in the history because I kind of jumbled it together, but you're correct. He was not against the death penalty when he went into office.
No, he presided over the execution of Andrew Corcoraleus while he was in office, and he said it was the hardest thing he'd ever done.
Mm-hmm.
So we are now today at this position, and once again, you know, Governor Quinn had said he supported the death penalty under certain circumstances, but was presented with this kind of extraordinary feat on the part of the Illinois legislature, which passed this bill, causing themselves any number of, one can only imagine the kind of introspection involved in this kind of a vote for a legislator in a state that had some problems with the death penalty, but it had a death penalty for many years.
Mm-hmm. And it appears that Quinn received the legislation 2 months ago.
That's right.
And sat on it to think about it and described this as a very difficult decision for him to make.
Yes, he did. And I left him a long message. I wasn't able to talk directly to him, but a lot of us did send messages in one form or another. And honored the fact that this is a guy who has the feelings he has, but that there are considerations that all of us hoped he would take into very serious thought, and he did. And his statement when he finally made his decision and really, I think, labored, struggled with the question. But his statement was a very good one, I thought, that he finally came to the understanding that there was simply no way to guarantee that a system like this could be absolutely foolproof, and that being the case, he couldn't support it.
Here's a quote from Governor Quinn: if the system can't be guaranteed 100% error-free, then we shouldn't have the system. It cannot stand, he said.
That's right. So God bless Governor Quinn, and what this does is continue the momentum that's been established now with the beginning with New York and then New Jersey and then New Mexico a couple of years ago, and now Illinois. I think what we're seeing is the inevitable death knell, if you will, of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. And, Mike, it's interesting, too, because, you know, I lived in Illinois many years ago. I was there when the original Mayor Daley was the boss of Chicago.
Oh, boy.
And I've always had a cynical, jaundiced view of Illinois politics. And I consider Pat Quinn to be an accidental governor. He did win re-election in his own right, but he was appointed to fill out Blagojevich's term when he was indicted.
Right.
And he's an old-style Chicago Democratic Paul.
Right.
And so for him to go through this deep deliberation for almost 2 months, and I give him credit. He talked with Desmond Tutu, the Archbishop from South Africa. He met with Sister Helen Prejean, who was the inspiration for Dead Man Walking. And, you know, this is unheard of in American politics because the polls show that the politicians who continue to pander to death penalty supporters get elected and reelected.
That's right.
And so if you're purely playing politics, you play to the grandstand, you play to the Coliseum, and you give them the blood that they are seeking, the vengeance that they feel will give victims closure, which is so often not the case.
Right.
And so, you know, for him to, you know, stand up and be prepared to take a lot of criticism from the proponents of capital punishment by consulting with people who deeply oppose it, that's just so breathtakingly different.
It is indeed. He's demonstrated great courage. It's been my contention for many years that the death penalty would not exist in this country today except for political cowardice. And what you've just suggested is that here's, or perhaps not the first time, but in a very unusual series of events, that this is a guy who has taken his vows of leadership, the notion that he has been elected to an office that requires him to be a serious leader of people, seriously. And he's done what is for most politicians a very frightening thing. So I give him great credit.
And many people, Mike, who don't follow this issue, think that Illinois is probably the first state to do this. But you referenced earlier that New Jersey eliminated its death penalty in 2007. New Mexico, under Governor Richardson, followed that in 2009. And so we now have 11 states that do not permit the death penalty.
15. Actually.
It's 15?
15. It was 13 for many years, and then the addition of New York, New Jersey, and New Mexico made it 15. And now we have 16.
Okay. And in New York, it was done by the state Supreme Court that declared the law unconstitutional.
Right.
Is that right?
That's correct. And the New York legislature has refused to do make the necessary changes because they've determined they don't want a death penalty there.
Uh-huh. But, so now 15 states, and this is a significant momentum in the last few years.
Yes. Yeah, we're seeing, and in fact, I will guarantee you that there will be more. Connecticut looks like it will go perhaps this year. The Republican Senate in Montana, for the second year in a row, has passed a bill to abolish the death penalty. And if it goes to if it is supported by the lower house, then it will be up to the governor. But Kansas had a tie vote last year about abolishing the death penalty in their state legislature. So. We're seeing more and more of this kind of activity, in significant part, frankly, because of the cost of the death penalty that people are becoming aware of in the face of this recession that has impacted so many states and localities, as well as the country at large.
Mm-hmm. And can you give us an example of that here in California? For example, we are spending millions of dollars to rebuild the death chamber at San Quentin Prison, and to set up a lethal injection process that will meet the approval of federal judge Jeremy Fogel. He has suspended the application of the death penalty in California until those issues are resolved. But we've had, what, now a four-year moratorium?
Five now.
Five?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Judge Fogel's essentially created a judicially created moratorium, which has been very frustrating to, I'm sure, people on the other side of the issue, but it's been very helpful to us because it gives us the opportunity to point out to people the wrongheadedness of so much of this.
Mm-hmm.
The question has been raised, and now the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice pointed out that it's costing us $137 million every year to maintain the death system. So there is a tremendous now growing question. I thought it was very telling that just a month or two ago there was a demonstration outside of San Quentin of disabled people who were saying that the governor is talking about cutting expenses, cutting the budget in ways that is going to impact on the ability of the people with disabilities to function properly. And they're saying, why not stop killing people and convert it to life in prison without possibility of parole, as was done in Illinois now, instead of these kinds of cuts that are going to have an impact on people that can't survive without the sort of support that the state has traditionally provided.
Mm-hmm. And so California is, we spend about $9 or $10 billion a year on the prison system. The state is under a federal court order to reduce the non-death row population by more than 40,000, and the state has been dragging its feet. And I'm sorry to say that the new governor, who was the attorney general, was part of the effort to challenge the federal order to reduce the population, claiming that it was an inappropriate violation of the state's independence.
Yeah.
And yet we know that historically, Jerry Brown personally was opposed to the death penalty. He earned great notoriety and controversy for appointing Supreme Court justices, including Rose Byrd and three others who were recalled because they overturned numerous death penalty convictions. So given the economic plight the state faces, do you see Governor Brown at some point moving in a direction to propose abolition of the death penalty, not for moral reasons, but for economic and practical reasons?
Well, the opening is there. It's a question of whether Jerry Brown has the courage to do it, and we have talked for a moment about the political cowardice that sort of runs things these days. But the opening is very much there. The problem with it being abolished is that it was established in California by the initiative process, and therefore it cannot be unilaterally abolished by the governor or the legislature without going through the initiative process. But what the governor could do is what Governor Ryan did, as you mentioned earlier, at the end of his term, which was to commute all the sentences of people on death row to life without parole, take them off death row, eliminate all the extraordinary expenses of death row, and save us hundreds of millions of dollars every year. And he could advocate for, as you just suggested, the abolition of the death penalty entirely.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he used a curious phrase as he was running for governor against billionaire Meg Whitman last year, Mike, where he repeatedly said, at this stage of my life, now he's 72 years old, and he may or may not run for a fourth term as governor, a second round this time, but he is in a unique position. Of somebody who doesn't have to play the political game the typical way. And he really could use some of the maneuvers that you just described, including a commutation process, to essentially, eliminate the death penalty for the foreseeable future. Now, he certainly would face a chorus of criticism,
yes.
And you certainly know how powerful the Prison Guards Union is,
right.
And the Crime Victims Bureau that they fund and promote. Whenever they need to trot people out to oppose any potential reasonable and rational revisions, either in incarceration policies or in our criminal justice policies. So can you imagine him taking that on under the present circumstances?
Well, I can imagine it. I can hope for it. And I'm going to personally encourage him to do just exactly that. You know, the CCPOA, the Correctional Officers Association, is an odd duck in. I can't imagine that they're going to be impacted seriously by the movement of 712 people off our death rows and into one of our institutions. I don't know how that's going to harm them at all, and therefore I don't understand how it is and why it is that they would oppose such an action.
Well, I'm thinking of, I think her name is Harriet Salerno.
Oh, Harriet and I are old adversaries.
And, Mike, just to give you an example, I've advocated for the rights of life prisoners to be paroled for many years. And a few years back, I went to Sacramento to testify on behalf of a bill that was intended to just allow the parole process to work without political interference. It didn't offer, promise release to any particular prisoner or group of prisoners. It simply said to stop the political interference at the parole board,
right.
And that the governors have been using for political reasons as well. And Harriet Salerno was there, and she did not address the specifics of the bill whatsoever. She simply brought out two other victims of grisly crimes,
right.
And they told their stories of the crimes.
Right.
And at that point, legislators of both parties just basically took a walk. That's what they do in Sacramento when they don't want to confront a difficult issue. And the bill died without getting out of committee. And so those are the kinds of tactics that they use.
Oh, no, indeed. Political cowardice is what we are faced with all the time in these kinds of situations. I served on the California Commission on Administration of Justice. I'm sorry, I'm saying it wrong. The Judges Review Board. And Harriet and I were actually on that panel together, so it was a very interesting interesting time. She's one who is a firm and strong, and I think emotional rather than intellectual opponent of anybody who does anything wrong and wants people to suffer repeatedly and forever when she deems that they've done something wrong. And it's a shame when somebody has a terrible experience, as her family did, to visit such horror continuously on the families of people down the line with whom they have no interaction, of whom they have no understanding, and for whom they evidently have no compassion.
Yeah. Well, and there are some very interesting attempts at victim-offender reconciliation.
Yes.
That have been tried on a test basis in the prison system. And I support it in general. Sometimes it's been promoted by Chuck Colson and some evangelical Christians who say that this kind of reconciliation only works if the offender has been saved by Jesus Christ.
Ah, yes.
And I have a little problem with that.
I'm with you.
But I do believe that this is a healthy process that can help victims and offenders and that could help pull out some of the vengeful attitudes and initiatives that really are part of the problem in our incoherent criminal justice policies.
I agree. The restorative justice movement that you've just described has had a tremendously positive impact in places like New Zealand and in actually little communities in our own state and around the country where it's beginning to, this victim-offender confrontation or communication process has really shown a lot of people that there is an alternative way to do it to the way we've been doing it for so long.
And this is a very mixed record, but as governor of Texas, George W. Bush presided over many executions. He had a terrible record. I think before Rick Perry took over, Bush had the dubious distinction of being the most frequent order of executions in Texas and perhaps in national history.
I think that's right, 152.
But he did permit a pilot program of this kind of victim-offender resolution to occur in Texas. And I only met George W. Bush once when he was running for president. And I talked to him about it because I couldn't think of anything else nice to say. And it was interesting because he perked right up.
Really?
He seemed very proud of it. And I was stunned by that. I thought he'd kind of blow it off and, want to talk about executing people who might have been innocent or who were not even, mentally competent to face that kind of a situation. But it was an interesting exchange, and he seemed to, appreciate that somebody knew about it.
Well, isn't that interesting? I actually had no idea that then Governor Bush was responsible for such a program, and I'm amazed that it has that's the case. I hope it has continued in Texas.
Yeah. Now, Mike, coming back to abolition of the death penalty on a state-by-state basis, it's important to note that the vote that passed the abolition in Illinois was bipartisan.
Yes.
Many Republicans did vote against it, but some Democrats did, too. And you mentioned that the Republican-controlled legislature in Montana has passed a bill. They have a Democratic governor there.
Yes.
I don't know what his position on the death penalty is.
I don't, frankly, either. I was up in Montana last year after the same Senate with the same Republican majority had passed the bill, and it was going to their lower house, and we were lobbying for support. And the governor had quietly indicated, as I understood it, that if the legislature spoke, he would support it. But whether or not that's still the case, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what other states? You mentioned Connecticut is on the brink?
Yeah, Connecticut legislature passed an abolition bill last year, and it was vetoed by the then sitting governor, who has been replaced by a governor who said if they pass it again, he will sign it. So that's a very distinct possibility this year.
Okay.
Colorado lost in its state Senate by one vote, such a move, so I think you'll see more action in Colorado. We've talked about Montana. Kansas, the state of Kansas, actually lost a movement to abolish by a tie vote.
Mm.
So that, again, suggests that there's a possibility of more movement in that area.
Now, their governor in Kansas is a former Senator Brownback, a staunch pro-lifer, at least on abortion rights.
Yes, at least.
Is he pro-life?
I don't know if his pro-life feelings go all the way to opposing the capital punishment.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've never heard him talk about that, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. Any other fronts that people should be aware of, Mike?
Well, I think Maryland, of course. You've got a governor who's very outspoken in support of abolition, but a legislature that's been slow to follow his lead, and they now have a study commission in place. And the study commissions, as you probably remember, in New Jersey, for example, converted a number of people to, as was the case with the study commission in Illinois. So one hopes that the more a state body will look at this case, at this issue seriously, the factors so clearly argue for abolition that I think we can always hope.
Yeah, and Mike, you've been at this for many years now. Is it 20 years or more?
30.
30 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I thank you because you speak for me and many Americans who believe it's barbaric, immoral, and counterproductive, not least of which highly expensive.
No, indeed, and bless you for that, Peter, and thank you for your continuing good work on the airwaves to educate people on this subject.
Well, thank you. And if people want to get more information, your website for Death Penalty Focus is deathpenalty.org.
That's it.
Very good. Mike Farrell, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Peter. Nice to talk to you.
Mike Farrell, the president of Death Penalty Focus. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. And here at my world headquarters, I get books, sometimes solicited and sometimes not. And I have two large bookshelves. One is the official bush-bashing bookshelf that I had to reinforce with metal rods in the summer of 2007. And the other one contains all different kinds of titles. And I was browsing recently looking for something else when I came across the book called If Olaya Street Could Talk, Saudi Arabia, the Heartland of Oil and Islam. Its author, John Paul Jones, sent me a copy in the summer of 2008. And I responded, I'm going to hold on to this and get in touch with you when Saudi Arabia is in the news. And today I follow through on that threat and welcome John Paul Jones to our program today. John, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for calling me back after those couple of years and remembering my book.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I think this is going to be very interesting for our listeners because you're going to offer us some views of life in Saudi Arabia based on your experiences there. You basically had two 10-year stints serving as an employee of an American company, the Frist Family Business, HCA, or its international division, HCI. And you're a Vietnam veteran. You decided to work in other parts of the world. Now, I want to get to your story in a moment, but first, the region has been the source of breaking news over the past few weeks. Everyone knows about the revolutions and the uprisings that have sprouted, starting in Tunisia, then Egypt. Libya is currently in a state of conflict, and some demonstrations have popped up in nations like Yemen, the tiny nation of Bahrain in the Emirates, and there has been some unrest in Saudi Arabia, but it's been pretty quickly suppressed. Let me start in Bahrain, because you were married there, John, and you've been there and I haven't. We have the report in the last 24 hours, as you and I speak here on the 15th of March, that Saudi troops numbering about 1,200 plus 800 police officers have rolled into Bahrain across the causeway that connects Bahrain to the eastern portion of Saudi Arabia. What are your thoughts about the uprising there, the repeated demonstrations in the streets, primarily driven by the majority Shiites who oppose the continuing royal rule, which is a Sunni family?
I think you touched on the essence of it there at the end, and it is a unique situation, I think, in the Middle East, that you have a minority, the Sunnis in Bahrain, ruling a Shia majority, and they're a substantial majority. I think it's 80 or 90%. So there's considerable resentment there about how the oil revenue is distributed. And, of course, the Bahrain has far less oil revenue to distribute.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the problem. In terms of the Saudi troops going in there, certainly the way they're going to look at it is the way we would look at if one NATO country was attacked.
Mm-hmm.
The other NATO countries are pledged to support it. There is something called the Gulf Cooperation Council. It's six different countries there in the Gulf region, of which Bahrain, Saudi Arabia are two members.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be very natural for the Bahrain ruler to say, hey, I need a little help here. I have this restive minority, and they're being influenced by Iran.
And isn't Saudi Arabia, the royal family there, aren't they concerned that this virus could spread across that causeway? Because there are tensions between Sunni and Shia in Saudi Arabia as well.
Absolutely. And that has happened historically in that country, that even in the 30s there were problems there. That's always been a problem for the royal family, is that where the oil is where the Shia are.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the workers in the oil industry were Shia, are Shia.
Mm-hmm.
The percentages are largely reversed. It's about 80 to 90% Sunni in Saudi Arabia, and it's 10% or so Shia. So it's hard to envision where an uprising of the Shia will constitute a real threat to the government.
And the King of Bahrain has declared a three-month state of essentially martial law, and that plus the arrival of these Saudi forces followed just by 2 days, a visit by U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates. Do you have any thoughts about the extent to which the U.S. gave advance approval of these recent moves?
Well, my gut feeling is that they did, yes, because I think it's the 6th Fleet is based in Bahrain.
That's correct.
Down in the southwest corner, and, of course, we want to protect our bases, and that being one, and the other one being in, the major one being in Qatar.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I would certainly think consultation was made, and the green light was given.
Now, if you could, from your own personal experience, talk about the law enforcement apparatus in Saudi Arabia, because there is an army, there is a national police force, I believe there are local police forces, and then there's also the morality police. Do I have that correct?
Essentially, yes. So you have the regular army, which was always, I guess, traditionally distrusted because of what happened with the regular army in, say, Egypt and Iraq. So usually they were placed on the periphery of the peripheral as, part of the country. For example, in Abha and Tobruk in the northwest corner. You have something called the National Guard, is the... I guess how it's usually expressed in English.
Mm-hmm.
And that is essentially what Crown Prince, now King Abdullah, that was his power base.
Mm-hmm.
So is it analogous to ours? No. It is like a separate army.
Mm-hmm.
And it is his base of patronage. And somebody needs a job, they can always join the National Guard. He has a whole health care system for him, and one of the best... health facilities in the country now.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you were involved in, management of health care facilities for the Saudi royal family in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I want to clarify a couple. First of all, one of the things you said, I always worked for the Saudi Arabian government.
Oh, I see. I thought you were a contractor from an American company.
I was recruited by Hospital Corporation International.
I see.
So, and during the first 2 or 3 years, they had the management contract on King Faisal Specialist Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And but even when they had that management contract, I was still directly employed by the Saudi government.
Okay.
And then after, I think it was in the early 80s, they lost that management contract, and then the Saudis decided to run the facility themselves. So.
And is there anything else you want to correct? I do like to get things right, and I'm not infallible.
No, that was the only thing. I did want to go on to, you know, you have the local police force, as you mm-hmm. said, and that's correct. And I think it's analogous to a local police force here. And then you have that great anomaly, which is called the Matawa. It's mm-hmm. the religious police.
And this is called, the formal name is the Society for the Preservation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice.
You got to love it. You really do. But, I mean, they're serious about that, and some people actually believe that this is an important aspect of that. And it's very important that in my book I talked about each of our personal dealings. I mean, it was my wife, myself, and my two children. And in 3 of the 4 cases, they were outrageous in their behavior towards us, and particularly towards me at one time, in which they brought me into detention over false charges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said you were making sex films and smoking cigarettes, and we know at least that you don't smoke.
We know at least that. But they may have saved my daughter's life. And, you know, to that, I have to give a lot of consideration. And that incident, if I can have about 30 seconds.
Go right ahead.
She did something. Imagine this, a teenager doing something her parents don't want. She walked up to the local, say, 7-Eleven, the local convenience store, which was about a block away. And a policeman saw her, and, of course, he's the figure of authority, and he put her in the back of his patrol car. And there was no reason to do this. This was civil police. And there was a very good chance that what was going to happen was he would take her to the desert and rape her. And fortunately, a patrol car of the religious police saw this happening, and they intervened and stopped it. So they actually did have a reasonable function, and in this particular case, they performed it correctly. But I can assure you, they're not just the bane of the existence of Westerners there. They primarily target Saudi men and women. And the vast majority, I think, of Saudis dislike them. But it's probably not higher than 60 or 70%, because there is those people who believe that morality needs to be enforced, just like this country.
And here's a passage from your book referring to your wife, Mary. You say, Mary knew how to play the Mutawa game well, and not until the events of 9/11 did she wear the abaya, or at least carry it with her, that's a headscarf, for emergency use, you put in quotes. One of the cardinal rules for a woman in Saudi Arabia was a variation of one from Vietnam. During the daytime, the Americans held the countryside. At night, it belonged to the Viet Cong. In Saudi Arabia, the Mutawa prowled at night, and generally, the daytime was safe, particularly the mornings. And you say that Mary was operating under these informal rules when the sneak attack occurred. So there is enforcement even for the proscribed or prescribed garments that women are supposed to wear in public.
Well, I think at some place in there, I went on to say that there really is no such thing. There is not this official uniform that if you wear that, then you're going to be okay. It is all about power. And these people have power. And if you dress one sort of way, so suppose you have your habaya on, which is actually the long cloak, and you don't have your head covered, well, they're going to get you for covering your hair.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have your hair covered and they're in the mood, they'll start on you about something else. for example, your toenail polish. So there is not a prescribed dress code, per se, that you can get away with.
Now, you named your book If Elias Street Could Talk, and you make references to Beale Street in Memphis, Tennessee, which is the site of many blues nightclubs. What's the comparison there for our listeners, John?
Well, I decided to start that because I was in a club with the, the Saudi, who was my boss, who had just hired me to come back to the kingdom. And I sat there and I was watching him and I thought, you know, he cannot possibly understand, you know, the black southern experience which the blues personifies. It's impossible he understands English, but what it really meant to, say, be in the Mississippi Delta, it was beyond him. And I thought, well, isn't that sort of like how I am? I mean, you look at the Middle East, and I've been there for 10 years, and there are so many things I still don't understand. And even one of the points I made was that after 20 years there, I still could find myself making subtle little cultural mistakes. So what I was trying to say there is, you know, it's difficult for them to understand us, but I think they have a better understanding of us. And it is very difficult because we don't take the time to understand them.
Well, I think it's a really useful metaphor because I believe, and I'll say this first about myself, that I have many stereotypical views of Saudi society. And that I, you know, the blues is an American idiom that is not necessarily accessible or explainable to people from other cultures. And likewise, the practices and societal norms in this strong Islamic culture are very foreign to me. And you kind of tilt at a couple of well-known American journalists, Tom Friedman and Maureen Dowd, both of the New York Times, in your book, and you ding them for a kind of cultural imperialism, if you will. Explain a little bit about how you think the American media, and in particular those two writers, mischaracterize life in the Saudi royal kingdom.
With Maureen Dowd, I'll start with her, because one of the bugaboos is always women's rights, how women are oppressed. And, you know, I've talked to many, many women over there, and you never really got that impression from them that this was so. This was part of their society. So when Maureen Dowd comes over for her week's visit, and that's all it ever is, the ambassador's wife, Ann Jordan, set up interviews for her to talk to high-powered, professional, competent Saudi women who have adapted to the norms of that society and are very impressive at any sort of level. And instead of interviewing them, and she never gave a reason why she didn't, she went out and did this cutesy little piece about negligees being sold to women in black bags. So we really lost a lot there, because she could have been a real advocate to say, you know, the man bit the dog. This is a different story here. That's the classic journalism metaphor. We don't keep saying the same thing over and over and over. The dog bit the man. Here is something different. And she didn't do that.
We'll get to Friedman in a minute, but yeah. Let's talk about this issue, because I do think that there is a fundamental standard of human rights that applies to women regardless of culture. And I think that, you know, the advance of civilization and the evolution of human behavior does require us to comment, at least, on what we see as repressive norms and behaviors that deny women fundamental rights. Now, whether driving a car or voting in elections that are rigged to begin with are meaningful expressions of women's rights, I think that's open to debate. But don't you think that fundamentally it is appropriate to at least compare, contrast, and offer observations perhaps short of judgment, on the differences between the way different societies treat women.
Absolutely. And I think your key word was observations. I'm happy to make observations about the differences, and I do want them to be accurate. And there are differences. For example, that in a court of law over there, the testimony of two women equal one man. I mean, that is fairly outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
So there are definite differences. But what disturbs me is the problems we have right here. And you may or may not know that, 15 women were killed on the west side here in Albuquerque and are buried up on the Mesa. And that concerns me. How did that happen in this city? That concerns me far more than can a woman drive over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not so much the women that are inconvenienced by this problem, it's the men. And how do I know that? Because I was one of those people. With my wife not being able to drive, and by the way, she never wanted to, for a whole different reason, because the driving itself is much worse over there than here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another observation, and it's even a judgment I'll make, that the driving is very bad. Of course, the Saudis themselves say this. That's the number one way that men get killed over there, is while driving. So my wife didn't want to drive, but it was a problem for me because I always felt obligated I had to take her around. Well, the Saudi men basically feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a number of taxis and that sort of thing to help ameliorate that. But for Saudi men to actually pressure me to get the U.S. Embassy to do something, I said, no, you do it yourself. It is your problem. You're the one that has to drive them around.
And so how do you balance these, your observations about the limitations on women's rights and roles with the cultural norms and essentially accepting that as an American visiting Saudi Arabia, you don't really have a role in telling them how their society should operate?
I think I'm one of the few Americans who normally realize that. Most Americans would go over there and be, rearranging the wallpaper, saying the wallpaper was bad. This is how you should change. This is how you should do something different. And I think that's a fundamental difference between Americans and Saudis, that most Saudis were willing to listen to how we did things in the United States. And maybe they could learn something from us, and maybe they could improve their life. Whereas the opposite was virtually never true. Americans were not willing to really look at that society and say, maybe they have something going on here that we should learn from. Can you name one?
Me?
Yes, I'm going to put you on the spot.
I'm asking the questions here.
Oh, that's right. But the point is, the thought probably never crossed your mind.
Yeah.
Maybe we can learn from them. Now, why don't you challenge me and ask me what would be one thing?
All right, what would be one thing that you would change if you were put in charge as the successor to King Abdullah next week?
No, I'm talking about what I learned from them to put into place in the United States.
Okay, answer your own question. Go ahead.
Yes, I'll add health care.
Well, that is a very significant issue, and certainly the safety net and the services made available to citizens and residents are a much greater safety net and a service base than we'll ever see in the United States.
Yes, so that's a key one that we could learn from. Another one was King Abdullah's willingness to greatly increase the number of scholarships that he gave to Saudi nationals. And he has at least 18,000 Saudi students in this country deliberately spread out in virtually every state except Alaska. And basically he sent them over here to say, this is American society. Stay away from our fundamentalist preachers who preach hate and this distorted view of the United States. The United States has good and bad. Go see for it yourself and make your own judgment. So it was a tremendous effort and an initiative that I certainly approve of, and I don't see us the reciprocity there. Where there's still this unwillingness to say, well, why don't we send people over there for a year to actually observe the country?
Now, John, let me ask you about the nature of the presence of Americans in Saudi Arabia. We know that one of the significant issues raised by Osama bin Laden in his original fatwa is that American troops and American citizens were on the sacred soil of Saudi Arabia, and the attack on the Khobar Towers was apparently motivated by that sensitivity. So did you ever encounter a kind of very personal rejection simply because you're an American who was in Saudi Arabia?
Certainly yes and no. I think for the up until the last year, I was widely accepted, and I never experienced personal hostility because I was an American. In the last year I was there, and that we're starting about June of 2002, up until the invasion of Iraq by American troops, there was definite hostility towards me for the sole reason that I was an American. And one of the things that I was quite disturbed about was one woman at our hospital said, if the United States invades Iraq, I will bring a machine gun to work and gun down any American I can. Rather personal, yes. And I made a fuss about that, and basically I got the support of the top administration that tried to suppress this, and I think that they did. Among other things, she didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was some hostility, and it certainly increased with that invasion towards all Americans, and in fact Americans were targeted, and they were killed simply because they were Americans.
And on that note, John, just react to this, because I have argued for many years that George W. Bush fulfilled the wildest dreams of Osama bin Laden by committing large numbers of American troops to other sacred Islamic ground, notably in Iraq, and that's where some of the holiest sites in Islam are located. And I believe that this was a huge blunder, not only because Saddam didn't have weapons of mass destruction and didn't pose any immediate threat to the United States or its interests there, but because we made this huge cultural blunder by ignoring the wishes and the protocols of devout Islamists.
Oh, by and large, I can say that I'm in the amen corner on that. Yes, I think we made a major blunder attacking Iraq. I felt that every single Saudi that I had any dealings with basically said we had a right to go get Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. And, you know, go for it. And you've got to remember that the Osama bin Laden threatened the vast majority of Saudis. He was after them more than he was after us. So they supported us there.
Mm-hmm.
But we got hijacked, as you know, into the Iraq War and dealing with someone who had nothing to do with it. And I can assure you, you've got to remember that Saddam Hussein rained Scud missiles on Riyadh. And I made a point of going around and seeing some of the sites that that had occurred at. So Saddam wasn't buddy-buddy with the Saudis. And they knew that. But the problem was the hijacking. If we had gone in there, gotten Osama as we should have, the whole thing could have been over in 6 months. And then we could have got back to some sort of normal relationship and not this endless war on terror.
And, John, another comment, somewhat of an aside in the book, but one that resonated with me, because back during the era of Desert Storm, the early 1990s, I was one of those people who was highly skeptical of the deployment of Patriot missiles, and that these examples of U.S. advanced technology would actually be successful in intercepting the Scuds that Saddam was tossing into Kuwait and into parts of Saudi Arabia. And you made a comment that I'd just like you to repeat for our listeners about your own investigation of whether those Patriot missiles had any success whatsoever.
Well, the success rate, to what I viewed, was zero. And I did mention that. I was not there during the Gulf War. I didn't leave because of it. I had left for family reasons and wanting to take a long trip in Europe. But when I went back in May of 1993, I sat down with a friend who was apolitical and maybe a little crazy, because when the Scuds came in, he was on the roof taking pictures of what happened. And he showed me his video, and it was 20 or 30 minutes long, and he showed me the Scuds coming in. And every single time a Patriot went up, it might have hit it, but if it hit it, the warhead still came in and exploded on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So success rate of zero.
Yeah, and in the U.S. media, it's played as if these were heroic and very valuable military assets that only succeeded. And there was a professor from MIT who I interviewed a couple of times named Theodore Postol, and he had been very critical and honest about the failure of the Patriot missiles, but it didn't fit with the dominant message from the Pentagon, and so was largely discarded by the American media. John, next I want to turn to...
If I could mention one thing, it did succeed in hyping Raytheon stock. It certainly did.
Very well put. Next, I want to turn to the Saudi royal family, because people are vaguely, in the United States, are vaguely aware of King Abdullah. He's been ill, recently returned to his kingdom. And we know Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador to the United States and was very tight with George W. Bush, smoking cigars with him on the White House balcony shortly after 9/11. And many people are still very uncomfortable with the special privileges that were given to relatives of the Saudi royal family who were in the United States after 9/11. And despite the no-fly zone that was the entire country at that time, they were permitted to fly on private jets and round up the members of the family, some of whom had been procuring racehorses in Kentucky, and fly them out of the country because they were concerned about reprisals from American citizens against them. And so the very special relationship between the House of Bush and the House of Saud has made many people uncomfortable. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are about that and the extent to which you saw a reaction to it among average people in the Saudi kingdom when you were there on your second tour.
Well, to me, how they were able to leave this country so easily and so quickly is inexplicable, other than that very special relationship. Personally, I don't think that should have happened. Certainly, probably 2, 3, 4, 5 the people were probably involved in the 9/11 attacks, and they left that way. On the other hand, probably 99% of the people who were allowed to leave, it was true that they had absolutely nothing to do with it, and that they probably would have been a target for reprisals. I think, 3 people were killed here in reprisal attacks, 2 of which were non-Muslim. But
they were Sikhs. Yes.
Yeah, they looked Muslim.
It just shows how some ignorant Americans with guns can operate. But, yes, go ahead.
So, yes, there is that special relationship, and certainly it bailed out the finances of George W. Bush when he was a failure as a businessman. So they called in some chips there, and that worked. Was it resented in Saudi Arabia? I don't think so particularly, no.
Mm-hmm. And so in a more broad sense, the relationship between the Saudi royal family and the Saudi people, it's certainly complicated. But I'll just mention a couple of facets, and one is that the royal family has a reputation of playboys who have done deeds that are certainly not countenanced by the Quran, wild sexual escapades, even in some cases homicides that went uninvestigated, unprosecuted. And how does that relate to the average citizen of the kingdom, particularly those who are very devout Muslims?
Well, first of all, everything you said is true. Certainly, I don't think that King Abdullah has had this reputation of being a playboy. It was King Fahd before him that did. I would refer to you to Paul Krugman's column in the New York Times, the most recent one, in which basically he was saying that when the very rich in this country violate the law, it's the prosecutors who people go after. It's not the people that violated the law. So it's the golden rule. It applies over there, and it applies here, that the very rich are rarely held accountable for their actions, or the politically powerful. You could never possibly imagine any American being taken to a war crimes tribunal.
Yeah.
So, but yes, is that true over there? Yes. Is the degree of resentment perhaps comparable to here? I think so. Maybe a little higher. Maybe a little higher.
Mm-hmm. Well, your comparisons are well placed, and I don't approach this that the United States is pure, perfect, ideal. But what I'm trying to drill into here, John, is the way that average Saudis respond to the rule of the royal family, and the extent to which the liberation virus that we referred to earlier is going to ripple through the Saudi population. Will the royal family be in charge a year or two from now, or do you think that they will make some moves to relax their rule, to expand popular participation? I wouldn't use the word democracy. But do you think that beyond some of the money that they've been passing around recently to mollify the citizenry, do you think that there is a substantial opposition that could ultimately moderate the rule, if not topple the royal family in Saudi Arabia?
In a word, no. I think that there isn't a substantial opposition. You have various small groups of clusters of discontent that are in the peripheral of the country. You have the Shia, you have the very liberals, you have a few other groups. But by and large, I think that they're fairly content with royal rule. They would like some changes. I think they would like it done in a peaceful manner. You don't see, and I have been in countries in which it's much more oppressive, and the only answer is overthrow the government.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see that there. You have this sort of velvet glove. These people have been doing this for 200 and 300 years, as long as this country has existed.
Yeah.
There has essentially been a House of Saud. There have been three kingdoms in that country, and they're good political players. So if they need to lean 10% to the left, they'll lean 10% to the left, and they have the money to do it. And then you've got to ask yourself, what are the problems? What are these reforms that need to happen? Now, I know you asked the question, so it's sort of a rhetorical one for me. I was looking at the New York Times, and they were talking about this glacial speed of reform. And, you know, I scratched my head because that country went through future shock. That's a reference to, I think, that Alvin Toffler book in the 70s.
That's right.
Talking about such a rapid change. And it did change to at least 10 times what happens here in the United States. And so how much more change do they want, and what do they want? To me, the key is, how much do your rulers listen to you, and do you see that impact your daily? And I think over there, they actually listen to the people more and respond more. And that is part of the problem, because there is this percent of the population, let's say 20 or 30%, that is quite religiously conservative. And they have to listen to those people and not turn their country into ours.
And, John, if you compare your first 10-year tour, primarily in the 80s, to your second, which ran through 2003, one of the differences was the introduction of Al Jazeera and the growth of the Internet and wider accessibility to it. How did you see any difference? And do the Saudi people now have a basis to compare their situation to those in other nations in the region?
Yes, I think during the first 10 years, you did see a large number of Saudis being sent abroad. So at some level, they had a basis to compare. It was their personal experience, and that might have been better. But in the second 10 years, the introduction of things like Al Jazeera and the satellite dishes, which, by the way, were technically illegal, but were on everybody's villa, was a safety valve. And that is, they didn't have to go to, a movie theater or whatever. You could watch it all in your home, and they have that concept that your home is your castle. So you could do that inside your home. So that helped. And then the Internet, I was very much involved in the introduction of that. The Internet, they still attempt to censor there, and I'm very familiar with how they do that. But it's like sweeping out the tide. It's something effectively you cannot do very well. Mm-hmm. I think Facebook learned when they tried to take down Al-Wali's Facebook messages.
Right.
He's the guy down in the Yemen,
mm-hmm.
who was born here in New Mexico.
Yeah, that's right. Very interesting. Well, John, I want to thank you for sharing your observations with us, and I want to recommend your book to people, If Olaya, O-L-A-Y-A, If Olaya Street Could Talk, subtitled Saudi Arabia, the Heartland of Oil and Islam. And I see there's a website at tazapress.com. Is the book still available at Amazon?
Yes, absolutely. Please go to Amazon and pick up a copy and tell me what you think.
All right. Just look it up under John Paul Jones, and again, the book title, If Olaya Street Could Talk. John, thank you for joining us today. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. Thank you very much for having me on the show, Peter.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. And before I wrap up this podcast, I just wanted to share with you some information about what's going on in Bahrain, as we referred to at the beginning of our conversation with writer John Paul Jones about his book about Saudi Arabia. And it's your tax dollars at work, because the royal family in Bahrain is a key ally of the United States. Last year, we spent about $20 million in direct military aid to the government of Bahrain, and the six Gulf nations that make up the alliance that has permitted Saudi Arabia to send troops and police to Bahrain is set to receive $70 billion this year alone. So we are very deeply involved in the situation there. And as I referenced, Secretary of Defense Gates was in Bahrain just 2 days before the current crackdown was initiated. And this crackdown involves 90 days of essentially martial law to try to suppress the protests, the injection of these troops and police from Saudi Arabia. And because of the American funding of the military efforts and the military organizations of both Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, this triggers two potential restrictions on further aid to these countries. And those are under the Export-Import Act and the Leahy Amendment, named for Senator Pat Leahy of Vermont. And in each case, this requires the executive branch, the White House, to essentially certify that human rights violations are not occurring with U.S. military supplies and implements, you know, like helicopters and tanks and those sorts of things. The U.S. has sent to Bahrain dozens of so-called excess American tanks, armored personnel carriers, helicopter gunships. The U.S. has given the Bahrain Defense Force thousands of 38 caliber pistols, millions of rounds of ammunition, from large caliber cannon shells to bullets for handguns. And to take one example, the U.S. supplied Bahrain with enough 50 caliber rounds used in sniper rifles and machine guns to kill every Bahraini in the kingdom four times over. In addition to all these gifts of weaponry, ammo, and fighting vehicles, in coordination with the State Department, the Pentagon oversaw Bahrain's purchase of more than $386 million in defense items from 2007 to 2009. Vehicles, weapon systems, Sikorsky helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters. So just like in Egypt, where the tear gas canisters hurled at protesters all said, "Made in America," if there is bloodshed on the streets of Bahrain, you and I will be paying for it, and we'll probably be blamed for it because of our support for this authoritarian monarchy and the resistance to the popular uprising against it. I welcome your comments. You can always email fullofit@peterbcollins.com. Hey, and thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds?